and welcome to the Courtney Turner Podcast. My guest today is Johnny Vedmore. He is an independent investigative journalist, and he is a phenomenal journalist. I love talking to him. He totally fills in the gaps on all of my research. So we are going to have a great conversation today for sure. He recently did a whole dive on the ancestry of Jordan B. Peterson. And those of you who may have seen, I did a recent, it's not that recent now, but I did, kind of a dive on Jordan Peterson's ARC, Alliance for Responsible Citizenship. And I called it the dialectical right arm of the to build WEF dreams. And that is exactly what it seems to be to me. I think I made that case pretty clearly, but you can go watch for yourself and, you know, do your own research and you be the judge. But that's definitely what it looks like, in my opinion. So, if you want to support the work that we're doing here, you can click the links below and you can do a direct Gives and Go. I'm actually going to be building Gives and Go. It was a huge honor. I have been invited to Geneva, Switzerland at the end of May. It's for the Geneva Project, and they're calling it the Inspired Leadership Global Summit. And it is the same weekend that the WHO is planning their pandemic treaties and all of the things to control and enslave humanity. That's at least my perspective on what it looks like. And we're going there to figure out how we can combat that and to preserve personal sovereignty and national sovereignty and the free will of humanity, really, is how I see it. So it's a huge honor, but it is a very, very big expense. So if you want to support me so that we can go and be a part of this historic event and hopefully see a big derailment in their plans, then you can do Gives and Go. You can buy me coffee. It might be a few coffees, but you can do a Venmo. You can send me to my P.O. box also if you prefer old-fashioned letters and checks and that sort of thing. It's 60401 Rural Plain Circle, Suite 110, number 106, Franklin, Tennessee, 37064. You can also do a Venmo at Courtney. I saw my name like Courtenay. So it's CourtenayTurner, Venmo. And then you could also just find products that I have here. If anything strikes your fancy, and you can get great products for yourself and support the podcast that way. And of course, the code on all of them is Courts, CourtZ. So without further ado, I'm going to bring on Johnny. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. I'm all right. How are you?
I'm doing well. Yeah. We had a lovely chat this morning. I get to spend the day with you here.
Yeah, I know. Isn't it cool? Isn't it cool? I like this. I do like having conversations with people who are like-minded, and we're doing a lot more of that at the moment. But you're right, at the start we've got like our research goes in parallel lines very much. Yeah. So we very close to the same. I find this with a lot of people on the indie media. People get their focus, they go forward, and I find them because I'm looking for that little bit of extra information or that bit of extra information. But yeah, love talking to you. I love talking to you. You know your stuff, you know your biscuits, they would say over here.
I like that. Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate that. You too. Yeah. And I do feel like it is. It's great synergy. None of us can know everything and none of us can research everything. There's just way too much. That's partly by design, I think. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. So what made you do this dive on? You did like a whole ancestry, like a tree of Jordan Peterson.
Went back quite far. Oh, I had a strange journey with Jordan Peterson, really. You know, this sort of like, I was really down. I'm really sad. I watched Jordan Peterson's Bible lectures maybe three times. I watched his personality lectures maybe three times. Yeah. There was a lot of them to watch as well. His Bible lectures are pretty long. They're like 13, 14, 15 parts, 3 hours long or something like that. Yeah. And he kind of like, he gives his whole... spiel, and it affected me well at a certain time. It also probably strengthened my resolve on certain subjects more than it did on subjects that were actually useful. And I appreciated it, though, because I was in a bad place in my life and I was trying to get better and I was looking for a way to get better. And of course, look at that progress. Okay. So you've gone from a really, really bad place. You wanted to you're down on your lowest. You're like, okay, now I'm going to have to change my life. Who can I listen to or who can I watch? Right. And who will people advise? And nearly, I at that point when I needed that, who else was I going to find online if I go onto YouTube or something than Jordan B. Peterson? And it helped a lot of what he said. He translates things in his own way, and sometimes it's like, oh, I never thought of it that way. But it doesn't mean it's the right way or the true way. It just means it's an interpretation. And that's very much like out of his Bible lectures. You listen to some of the stuff he says. It's like, wow, I didn't even think he could mean that. But that's really well, like, phrased, well worded, well twisted, so that you have like a narrative. And there is a narrative there with Jordan B. Peterson. He actually follows me on Twitter, and he only follows about 500 people, and it's really bizarre. It made me go, right, okay, well, there's my love of Jordan B. Peterson from that part, but then there was a separate point what happened, which was the introduction to my life of the intellectual dark web, as they call it. So yeah. Eric Weinstein, Brett Weinstein, Ben Shapiro, Joe Rogan's hanging around there, Dave Rubin's probably in the background, Douglas Murray is in the toilet. yeah, that's a good one. I like that one. Yeah.
Some of them like adjacent, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And Jordan B. Peterson's hanging around. And I was like, okay, I wrote an article when I was sometimes writing articles I didn't need to write. I had to, if you're going to write really like well-researched top articles, you've got to only do that because it takes up all your time. So you can't write loads of little articles. Like, that's like a hardship. That I had to kind of accept that I shouldn't. But when I did, one of my articles was for a free to use kind of platform called Vocal Media, vocal.media, and listen to or watch the intellectual dark web, because you'll kind of know the antithesis of your own belief. You'll see there's a selection of different people there who you might not agree with, but you'll learn something from each of them, whether it be positive or negative. And I found them very interesting. And then I started to look into each of them. So Eric Weinstein was the real eye opener, because most of them were very clever, were very switched on. Yes. Ben Shapiro's really switched on. Like, I wrote an article about him about that time when I looked into him, which was like, he's 96% whataboutism. He just dresses it up in careful words, but it's always, yes, but what about this or what about that? And it's a lead nowhere argument. And he only destroys kids. He looks like he tries to destroy and takes on the attitude. And most of his videos now are him staring at things, watching things. And people are watching his reaction like they like to look at his face. And that should tell you a lot, that they've come to the fact that it's no point in him speaking anymore. He could just watch a policeman take down a bear or something. And he's like, oh, yeah, yeah. And everybody's like, oh, my God, Ben Shapiro, 12 million likes. And it makes sense, but it doesn't make sense. So Ben Shapiro was like 96% whataboutism. Brett Weinstein
Before you go on to the next one, I'm so sorry to interrupt you, but I did an interview because, I lived in L.A. My ex was actually very good friends with Jeremy. I was part of FOA. So I knew Jeremy pretty well. And he was on my podcast very early when I first started. So he goes through the whole genesis of Daily Wire. So it's an interesting for anybody who's curious about like the the early seeds of Daily Wire. He really does lay it out. So I just wanted to
share. Yeah, I do think there's something, there's something obvious about it, really. You know, when they construct a media organization nowadays, everybody who knows knows, and everyone who doesn't gets on board. That's the kind of the way it works. So Ben Shapiro, he's got this popularity, and I was like, please, all, what about it? I went, yeah, to work. Every day I was working in a Travelodge hotel, a 2-star hotel, behind a reception desk, writing articles, like ignoring the guests. No, I was lovely. I'm a lovely receptionist. and I was walking to work and I was listening to Ben Shapiro every day on the way to work. Fucking hated him. But I was like, I got to get over my hate for the other side. I realized one of the things I realized was very interesting, I suppose, because, and I think it's something that happens to all of us and we might not vocalize it properly, that has happened. And I've had an event recently which someone's talked about this sort of stuff. But I think locally, the scene in Cardiff where I lived was very left wing. Mm-hmm. And a lot of like ideology comes suddenly and fluxed into this area from about 2014, 15, 16, 17. And mm-hmm. This was about 2017, I think 2018, maybe 2019. But anyway, it was like there was a load of people who got pushed out of groups, friendship groups split up. People became like defined trans or polyamorous was everywhere. And there's lots of friendships that went sour really quickly, and lots of people were I actually, there's a journalist called Nick Cotton who came on with the comedy festival I was at a couple of days ago. He got pushed out of this area. I had known him. I had worked in Virgin Megastores once upon a time, and I knew his wife. But he got publicly like ousted from this sort of left wing sort of community. And I wanted to understand. I felt like I was on the left back then. I felt like right. I was definitely, that's where I was. Those were my people. I know. I hang around with them all the time. I go to the pub with them. I go to the bar with them. They surround me. And then it was like all of this stuff happened. And I was like, okay, know your enemy then. Okay, let's know your enemy. Let's go and look at the other side. All my first articles were about the antithesis of my own, what I supposed I believed from the lack of information that I actually had. So I kind of went on this journey where I wrote a load of articles where they were focused, like my first major article was on Laura Koonsberg, who was a political mm-hmm. correspondent who was really against Jeremy Corbyn. And I was like, left wing Jeremy Corbyn. And so of course I'd be, why wouldn't I investigate her? And then there was Theresa May. I mean, Theresa, the one about Theresa May's father that's on the screen there, a top story in June 2017. In one day, I didn't have any advertising. I had like 250 followers or something on Twitter, and that got 250,000 views in like a week. That was Theresa May's father worked with a serial killer, and this is just before the election, and I was like, how can I find a way to write an article that makes sense? Let's go and investigate family history again, because I enjoyed doing mm-hmm. it with Laura Koonsberg. That was my second one, and that kind of led me down that way. So I had listened to Ben Shapiro every day thinking, what are my beliefs? I'm going to challenge the other side. I better know their beliefs. So I listened to him every single day. What an arsehole, every day having to listen to Ben Shapiro in my goddamn ear. And I grew to enjoy listening to someone I didn't like to listen to. Mm-hmm. I grew to enjoy that. I tried to like sort of capture that feeling that I've got to take in data from the other side if I'm going to ever understand the other side. And that like intertwined with my experience with Jordan Peterson as well. So, but I enjoyed listening to Jordan Peterson. It's just some of the things seemed like it seems slightly underhand. I'd be happy to talk and discuss this with Jordan B. Peterson mm-hmm. in length. You know, I'm really eager on the idea of being able to have a conversation with him, because I think there would be a load of things, questions I would have. I know it's very unlikely to happen, but there would be a load of questions that I would have. But one of the things was like, Eric Weinstein was the real eye-opener. Brett Weinstein was a whiny little shit, yeah? So he was going, oh, we had to hide in the building and lock the doors because they were so angry. And it was just like unbelievable. It was like, come on, grow some balls, man. And then he grew a podcast out of that. And it was like, okay, that makes no sense, you know?
The Dark Horse podcast, both of them did, yeah.
So terrible. And like when during COVID, the whole like how to wear a face bandana stuff, that's amazing. Okay, so I went on to X. That was round loads a couple of months back. People were tweeting it round all over the place. I went on to X, looked for it. I couldn't find one. It's like they've all been wiped off X. It's just insane. Maybe I'm blocked from seeing that. Maybe this is the way it works.
You know? I'll look.
It's very strange. But the whole, you know, Brett Weinstein just seemed wet. But Eric Weinstein was really interesting. And it really, this is really leading on to Jordan B. Peterson.
Sure, no, the whole IDW, I get it.
Yeah. Eric Weinstein was completely and utterly something else. I couldn't get him at all. I started watching his stuff. So I was watching all these guys' stuff. I was like, I'm going to listen to all of it. I'm going to analyze it all. And he was also whiny, but he had this undertone of Zionism in there. He had an undertone of supremacy. He has a large, like, deceit in abundance. A lot of deceit in nearly everything he says, everything he does. I feel like I can't trust him and I don't trust him. Mm-hmm. So I was like, okay, what did he do? He goes on about hedge funds. He's in this hedge fund where we had to think differently and everything. And then the theory of everything, which is balls. It's balls. His theory, there's not many people. His theory of everything is complete balls. Marcus de Soitoy was like, oh, it's amazing. He's so amazing. He's wonderful.
From so many people.
but that just signals to me that Marcus is a little bit dodgy and might be working for the same agenda, because I looked back on Eric Weinstein. You know, you go back to, he talks about his Epstein experience. Oh, I met Epstein once and it was, I knew straight away because he knows, because Eric Weinstein knows everything, because he's the everything man, I suppose, isn't he? Well, wait a minute, isn't a guy who knows everything also called an arsehole? I think they are. So anyway, he knows completely and utterly.
Well, everything. I also think he's got kind of like he might be kind of like an intel operative, so they tend to know a lot also, or at least predict that they know a lot. Yeah, so I think that's
intelligence.
Right. Yeah, they're very intelligent.
Before he was at the hedge fund, he was at Edge when it was 100% funded by Epstein. There's no way he only met Epstein once. That's a load of balls, and he knows it fully well. That was 100%. There was no Brockman anymore involved in Edge. Before that, he was working for the UN. The UN keeps coming up all of the time. Oh, what a surprise. What's he doing at the UN? Well, he's not going to answer those questions easily, is he? Because he's Eric Weinstein. He's a man who knows everything. He doesn't need to answer to you. So he really, you know, as the old saying says, grinded my gears. So I was like, all right, collection. Now, as a collective, what are they doing? The intellectual dark web. So you've got, say, for instance, Joe Rogan, who's this massive podcast, like the biggest amount of views, gets paid this massive amount of money. Everybody gives him anything. He's freedom. They banned you from certain platforms. You go to Spotify or whatever and get paid $100 million, and they'll ban you some more. And poor Joe Rogan. And it's the same with Ben Shapiro and everything.
They act like Richard is Joe Rogan.
Yeah, I know. That's what I mean. It's just Ben Shapiro gets loads of time. There's Brett Weinstein gets loads of time. Eric Weinstein gets as much time as he wants. Eric Weinstein is like a Palantir with Peter Thiel. It's insane. He's like one of the highest people. But of course, you don't need to, like, does everybody see what's happening? They're a dirty bunch. Oh, is this called the intellectual dark web now? Oh, so Sam Harris, of course. I mean, you go vacuous. Old Sam Harris. I haven't got those pictures are really hard. So Dave Rubin classes himself as intellectual dark web. Who's the first guy? What's that first guy?
The one on the left here?
Yeah, the far left. Who they put on the far left? He's right.
I can't quite picture who it is. He looks familiar.
I don't really like this. There was the group before as well, but yeah, Sam Harris in there, Brett Weinstein, of course, Ben Shapiro was officially intellectual dark web right at that start moment.
Yeah, of course.
And they had this picture of them all sitting around the table where they're having their little chitty chat. And I just found it really interesting to then examine each of these people and what they did. And it led me to realize that it seems to be some bigger op. I don't know who would be running this op, but it's a very simple one. And it seemed to be like suddenly the trans movement appeared. And at the same time the trans movement appeared, these guys suddenly appeared as the antithesis of the trans movement and whooped up every single person who was. Yeah. So this is like four of the intellectual dark web here, what's called the internet. And I think Jordan Peterson took loads of drugs, partially because he knew what he was doing. I think he felt really sad about what he was involved in, but it was very lucrative. And I do think he has some form of understanding of what was happening. Then afterwards, he was a lot more kick-ass when he came back. And then, you know, everybody who did the whole, or you think you should take the vaccine all of a sudden, just, and they're intelligent. That's like a real signal where it's like, oh God, okay, you shouldn't be, you know, shouldn't even be telling people. If you're intelligent enough, you know, let people make up their own mind, and you shouldn't be telling people. So telling people is the problem. Like, I when he come back, he was like Dark Peterson almost. Not to me. I always knew that he was just Jordan Peterson before and after. But I found him very interesting because he had that much of an effect on my life that I see him as both good and bad. And I think that all humans should be judged like that. And he makes up his own mind. I mean, he makes up his own mind. But then I went and said, okay, recently, I'm going to do something that kind of hasn't been done yet to this level, I'm going to go and start building the family trees of some of the biggest influencers, some of the politicians. You know, if I can find the time here and there, because it's hard, because I also had to like take up some work doing genealogy for other people, so I don't get much time like between all of the other stuff.
I understand.
But if I can, then I wanna go through. So I've started on Robert F. Kennedy Jr. next.
Oh,
it's really interesting. Really interesting.
Yeah.
Really, really fascinating. It's because you don't think about it. You think, oh, but he's a Kennedy, mm-hmm. Kennedy. Well, that's half. He's half Kennedy. The other half's very interesting. It's, you know, they think dynastically. They think about who's been before. And the Kennedys were desperate to marry into dynasty. And that is very obvious with so Robert F. Kennedy Jr. He's half Kennedy, but he's half the rulers too. this is interesting. Okay, so this is interesting. Jordan B. Peterson, and the reason why I started with him is Jordan B. Peterson, and I mean, the theme tune is, I made a banging theme tune. I mean, I did the synth. It all goes backwards because it's backwards in time, of course. So all of the synth instruments go backwards. It's completely like awesome tune that goes with it. And it has Jordan Peterson speaking over the top of it. And Jordan Peterson is saying, like, you know, you've got to know about history. Yeah.
You're a historical creature.
You're a historical creature. You've got to know. If you don't know about yourself, if you don't know who, how can you possibly know who you are? Right. You know, so he's all about the other part of it, personality lecture-wise.
Yeah.
He's all about talking about, and in the Bible lectures, othering. The dangers of othering. While at the same time, with the trans stuff, there was a lot of what would be obvious othering going on.
Right.
And he warns about othering over and over again. And yet that thing is a blind spot for loads of people. I love those blind spots, because those when someone does something like you know, opposes something big and has a whole life, then there's likely to be contradictions within there, unless you were perfect. And none of these guys who opposed it are perfect. But I was trying to say today on the one half of the radio show that you know, you shouldn't be aiming at the people who have been tricked into following these ideologies. You really should be targeting the people who are pulling the trigger and moving the scalpel and saying it's you who needs to stop. You're messing around with people who can be convinced, and humans can be easily convinced. But anyway, Jordan Peterson was an interesting place to start because of that othering and the necessity to know history. So I can't see a problem with me looking through his family history. And I wasn't going to go, I'm going to find that he's the president of, you know, Uganda or whatnot when it was the worst time, you know, whatever. he was related to Idi Amin. No. Yeah, I wanted, at the start, don't get me wrong, at the start, yeah. I know that I could find it, you know, I'm working under an idea here. If they've got something big in their family tree, if they're big, they might have something big in their family tree. That's sure. it. So, yeah. so that's the proposition. Is it true? So I started off and I made some, family trees, you go through and you build it all out, and then you work your way backwards looking for different errors and mistakes and seeing if everything matches up, and make sure that you got, because you will make errors and mistakes. Yeah. At one point, for instance, I found that, and I think if Jordan B. Peterson has had his family tree done, he thinks he's directly related to King Henry the VII, because Mary Tudor, not Mary, Bloody Queen Mary, but Mary Tudor, Henry the VIII's favorite sister.
Right.
So you would think that he would be related to Henry the VII. And I think most of the family tree lines that were naturally made up on these sites led to that conclusion. But it was actually, it was a different fourth Earl of Derby. It wasn't that Stanley. It was the other Stanley. There was two Stanley families. Stanley family was a real big deal in England. Yeah. They were still the same family. But it kind of like loops around that one relation that leads you to being related to a Henry the VII. But on another line, he was related to Edward the II, Plantagenet. So he's still pretty big.
Right.
I was going to go there. Mm-hmm. I think loads of mistakes have been made. So sure. Other people have not looked through their stuff. And if they looked through their stuff properly, then they would have gone, oh. And so Jordan B. Peterson might think that he's related to that, but he's not. I had to work out a lot of the, iron up stuff. I thought his mum was someone different at the start. I thought she was died at a different time and stuff. And then, it's all of that sort of stuff. Trial and error, and you get to the right, end up at the right place, and you realize, okay, there's no more errors here. And it was interesting because the one half of his family tree are Norwegian. One half of that family tree is not related to Jordan B. Peterson genetically, because one of them was actually adopted. So I can't remember if it was Walter Peterson. No, Walt's his father, but it was
his father's Stanley father. Peterson.
It was a Stanley. I think it might have been his
father's father, right? The grandfather, paternal grandfather. Yes, yeah.
So he was adopted by Bernd Peterson, and I think he was Josephine Peterson. And it's really interesting. You go through the family history in Norway. This was not, I say in the thing, this was not Norway's finest hour. Norway's finest hour was probably 800 odd years before, when it was the Vikings and it was ruled by these guys who had the top of the tree technology in ships, and were able to quickly storm inland and take slaves and belongings extremely quickly. So no one could hang around on the coasts of Europe back in the day. And then eventually, of course, for people who know history, you'll know that in like the 900s and 1000s, what happened was the Frankish Empire said, all right, you keep raiding us all the time. How about we just give you Normandy? And so a guy called Rollo of the Vikings was given Normandy, and it was like the first of the line of the Duke of Normandy. And one of the sons of the Dukes of Normandy was William the Conqueror, or William the Bastard, or whatever you want to call him. And so that then, that's, of course, these are all very big guys. So it wasn't Norway's finest hour. There wasn't much royalty or anything there. It was very humble. And Jordan B. Peterson, he always focuses on his Norwegian family much more than he focuses on anything else. And I found, you know, I love looking at psychology.
Yeah, fascinating.
Yeah, and so Jordan B. Peterson, that's one of the most interesting people to watch, isn't it? Because you're watching a man who, you know, this is, there you go. Okay, so 932, he died. Massively important to history, this guy. Massively important. I went over to the other side, and it is his mother's line that was really interesting. Ends up in Britain pretty quickly. You end up a lot in Somerset, where some of my family's from, in a place called, so some of my family's called from Wedmore, but lots of his family are from Wedmore. And my name Vedmore, I haven't traced back to Wedmore. I haven't traced it back to Wedmore yet.
Okay.
That's another line, which is all from Wedmore. But it's weird when you go back through ancestry. And this is the thing. Okay, so you end up coming to the conclusion that Jordan B. Peterson teaches in looking at Jordan B. Peterson's family tree, that you are not just one person. So if you have a long line, that's one family line, but you've got two grandparents, four great grandparents, 8, 16, 32, 64, 128, so on and so forth, till you've got a million ancestors. That is mind-boggling. You are a collection of that many. So the further you go back, the more people you got a selection from, so the more likely you are to find something. But you do not always find something. Some people, I'm working on one guy's tree. I've looked on the one half, and it's like decent, like sort of people, just people living their lives. And it goes back, and it's like they're stuck down. There's no point where it like bumps up a level. But I think his wife's side will be completely different. That'll be much more. That would be much more fruity, and people know this. And someone else I'm looking into at the moment, I mean, it's so interesting. They know, it's like there's an element of shame to discovering that your ancestors were once wealthy, or the mayor of London. One of the ladies looking into at the moment, the mayor of London, or I'm doing her genealogy for her, quite far back, about 1400s. But these are really interesting lines to go through. When I went through Jordan B. Peterson's line, it went through a lot of the Wookiees, and that meant the Wookiee from Wookiee, which isn't a or whatever. I'm not going to do a Wookiee impression right now. It's a terrible attempt to do it. It was a place in again Somerset called Wookiee. There's actually a place, a load of caverns called Wookiee Hole, which are a selection of caverns you can go visit. They're really good. It's down in the Cheddar Gorge, if I remember correctly. So it all sounds pretty, doesn't it? All of that sort of region is quite wonderful. Yeah, there he is. There he is. He's always going to come up. But that line is very interesting because it leads to the Stanley line. That leads one of the other lines that comes off there goes back to the Plantagenet king. So gets to Edward II through what is their name? Dymox, the Dymox family. It was quite a big family back in the day, and the Dymox were married into those the Plantagenets just around the time the Plantagenets were kind of losing because they lost in the War of the Roses.
Right.
And what happened was Henry the VII, once he had defeated them, was like, okay, and now I'll marry your daughter. And I'll combine the Tudor and Plantagenet houses under the Tudor rose. So that was like the final, like destroy the house in that sense, be the biggest thing in the house is joined together and they can no longer war with their own. That's the old way of doing things. These are big people, of course, on that line. On the other line, though, oh my God, it was just astounding. And on that line, if you're related to Edward Plantagenet, you can go back further and further. You're obviously related to Edward the First and Richard the Third or whatever, and you go back and you end up at emperors, Byzantine emperors, you end up at loads of different things like that. On one of the other lines, on the Wookiee line, you go back through the Stanley family, and even though it's not the same Stanley, you loop around to five generations back, the same ancestor. And you go back through that line, you get back to Haleva de Falaise. And Haleva de Falaise was bathing in the river one day when Robert, Duke of Normandy, saw her and was like, "You're mine," and gave her a baby called William the Conqueror. And he went on to conquer the Harold, of course, in Britain, and created what we know today. Really started off that the amazing from the Battle of Hastings from 1066. They installed across the land, they installed their own governors, Normans. They were brilliant. William the Conqueror cannot be, he had been trained by people who had been passed down the skills of the Vikings from Rollo and his ancestors. Remember, like, you know, after Rollo, they were marrying Viking women into the family. So part of that family history then goes off to the Viking kings and queens. And then if you follow down another line, you end up to the Welsh and kings and queens of old Wales back in the day, back in the day before William the Conqueror got over there. So in that sense, you can go back all the way to Brutus on one line. And I wasn't able to completely confirm it. It was just like it led to Mark Antony. And so you're like, that one's a complicated one to look into, and I've already got so much. I'll go over here and have it. It was just emperors after emperors. And then you get back to Charlemagne, of course. Almost everybody gets back to Charlemagne. But on two or three different lines. And what you discover is that I don't know if this is true. And this is why I'm going on this journey. This is the exploration part of it, is trying to understand whether or not it's the amount of royalty and bloodlines you've got and the types that dictate where you are in the hierarchy now, today, in the modern world. And I'm trying to understand if that's so. Now, Jordan Peterson's got, from one line, a complete array of royalty going back to the Merovingian. So, you know, that's supposed to be the bloodline of Christ.
Bloodline, the bloodline, right? Yeah,
the bloodline and the Carolingians as well. So across, I mean, you get back to some of the biggest people in history. A rumor of Lady Godiva. I don't think there's any definite evidence. It's a rumor she was married to the guy that I think it was Lufa the First. Back during that time, Lady Godiva was famously, when William the Conqueror invaded England, she was the only one in the country apparently who kept her land. who kept her area. Right. Everybody else had it taken away. And like I say, installed with Norman Gay. It was just systematic. They were like, they had learnt that the way to appease a potential enemy was to install your governors in every area, just like the Frankish kings had done when they installed Rollo into Normandy. So they learnt that through that. That was part given to them from that sort of Viking victory that then was appeased with land. Then you've got all of these warriors appease them with areas of land and control the land and create what we know today. I mean, it's one of the most important moments in history for Britain, America, for France, for loads of, you know, it was a union as well. For years and years, they only spoke French really in England, and it was like some like sort of pig English, I suppose you could say, in different regions of England. It wouldn't be till I think it's William Tyndale, who was one of the ones who wrote the first Bible in English, that he created most of the words that we don't even realize today. We use loads of these words that William Tyndale created for the first Bible, because there was no words in English to actually describe these things. And he made words that were very onomatopoeic. You know, they were very amazing. So all of this is like, it's a rolling ball of history. And what you realize, this is where Jordan Peterson, I'm sure, would agree, is that you can't other somebody because they are everybody. We are all with these mix of shared ancestry in different ways. Mm-hmm. And yeah, there could be an idea that there's groups that are cultish, kind of lean towards massive establishments and organizations and stuff, that these things have always existed. And your relatives have been a part of all of them. And most people just follow their name. And I've done this on articles, so because it's simple to explain. When I did Bill Gates and went through Bill Gates' ancestry, I only went through the Gates line, the name right. Gates, and right. I went through that one line all the way up and got back to Jeffrey Gates, the third and second and first, Sir Jeffrey Gates, the second and third, and the third was not only an advisor to King Henry VIII, but then to his poorly sickly son, and then had his head chopped off for trying to install another ruler on the throne. Oh, there he is, my boy Bill. All right, Bill, how are you doing? And so yeah, you go back and you realize you're related to loads of people because you've got loads of names. You've been so many people, and every generation you go back, you've got a new name because that mother, well, mostly in Gates family, there's a couple where it's Gates marrying Gates, and they're marrying the same ancestors as Stephen Gates, the first and second, who then meet up later as kissing cousins, like second or third cousins. But that time, who's counting and all of this, but I mean, it's so beautiful. It's the story of life. Mm-hmm. People love meet each other, right. And it, like, families are massive. They don't, you know, you there's no hard and fast rule, but what you discover is that there was these elite that go up to, and there is rumors that one of Jordan Peterson's ancestors was Knights Templar, but I wasn't able to confirm those rumors. Okay. But you could see that you go back far enough and you find someone like this, and their line shows kings and queens and sirs. Everybody's a knight. I mean, everybody's a bloody knight in that family. And you look at it and you say, oh, that's an influential person. And you look at someone else's tree, and of course they don't have that sort of influence. Does that come down the line, and is there someone somewhere marking that down, and do we then have any option of whether it's true or not? Because what you discover is there's loads of people like that in the 1400s, 1500s and before, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But when they expand out, there's less money to go around, less wealth to go around, less land to go around. They're all having 10 children. And like half of those are women who are marrying into other families, and then they're having 10 children and so on and so forth. And by the 1700s, late 1700s, none of them, though, they're from really rich. They just got rumors that granddad was big in the government once upon a time or something. They haven't got a direct connection with those events, and they just like lose those events. So it's like the family of Jordan B. Peterson that came from those big lines seem like really fine, decent people who did very decent things. And you go back, and a lot of them were, and there's some that were involved in drama, but then you get back to kings and queens, and then we can all make our minds up about what we think about kings and queens. But everybody was living under certain paradigms. If you're related to one king, you're also related to a load of other kings, emperors, empresses, you know, going back to the 400s or whatever. You can, in that sense, because it's the Welsh kings, the Vikings and the Welsh. There's lots of records that you can't say are definitely perfect, but it's people later on repeating from word of mouth, the ancestors of ancestors of ancestors. And it's difficult in Welsh because you have like Llywelyn ap Gruffydd. So you have Llywelyn of Gruffydd. So it was his father, his first name was Gruffydd. So it wasn't his second name. So it's Gruffydd ap something else, and then it's something else. So they've had to remember him all the way down to King Brutus, which is like, 700 BC. So if you believe the Welsh people who have managed to remember the names of the kings and queens historically, if you believe that's true, then you can go back to 700 something BC in Jordan Peterson's family tree. And that shows some sort of, because it does seem to be that there's levels I've been tasked by one beautiful woman who I love so much, and she knows exactly who she is. She's been completely great, and she started me off doing genealogy stuff. She actually hired me to do it when I really, really was down on my luck and etc. And that led me partially to being like, well, I could do this with Jordan B. Peterson as well. And then that took off really quickly. So she was really inspired the whole thing. And her family is, it's weird. It's like you could see Jordan B. Peterson's family goes back to kings and queens and stuff. Her family is just under that level. Just like, you know, they're quite high up, but they're not like the top level. So you can see that there's difference between levels and what's acceptable. But I also seen, it feels to me anyway, that there is like also groups that didn't marry into each other. So I'm not sure if that's going to be true or not. But when I map it out further, but I feel that the Prussian people who are related to the Prussian royal family are kind of like separated. They keep to themselves.
It doesn't seem that way.
So I just wonder if that sort of genetic trait to choose people who are similar to what your genetics desire. And so if that happens, but I just don't know if that is actually true. But that is the kind of journey of looking into Jordan B. Peterson's family tree, you know. So it was a bit of a he helped me understand a lot about myself, but he used other people's sort of experience and good work to do that. He described it in a way that made sense. And at the same time, he had this other thing. He had this unbeatable factor. His interview with the Channel 4 lady, who I just despise anyway, is just Kirsty something, I think her name is. It was just fantastic. He just disposes of her and her silly arguments and makes it gets to a point where she's like, oh yeah, I didn't even think about that. And she looks confused, like he's melted her mind. I like that. That's something that we desire. And mm-hmm. he knows what we desire. These guys know, they can get told as well. And I think there's a mixture amongst these guys. People who know how to, people who know how to work. He looks quite young there, doesn't he? he did well, and he's like me with his scruffy and iron shirt. Oh, you terrible, just like me, Peterson. There may be a relation or two because he's got a load as well. He's got a load of people from Wedmore in his family history, and I do too. So there might be a crossover in relation. So that's something you discover too. Discover that we're a beautiful mix of a load of different people, and when you actually understand it, you realize you can't be othered because you are the other. That's kind of like an extremely interesting like feeling that it gives you. And I've started doing my own family tree as well. I think I'm not up there. I'm like lingering around. It seems to be maybe that just as simple as some genetics do this level and some genetics do this level in being able to adapt to paradigms that are social or cultural that are existing around. And there's an adaptability gene, and that is at this sort of level. So when maybe there's a culpability gene, maybe there's a selection of genes that make you decide to or give you a character that's more likely to take risks and so seek greater rewards as well.
Well, there is a risk-taking gene. It is the RDR4 with the 7th allele. Attribute it to the financial risk-taking, but I really think it ascribes to much more than that.
Probably across the board.
Yeah, I always say that, because if you think about financial risk-taking, a lot of that is like survival. It's tied to survival, whether consciously or not. So I think I always say, like, I think Americans, that's what they're trying to breed out of Americans. I think that's part of the whole education system is about. And I think they know because this country was founded on people who took the biggest risks of all to found this country. So I think, theoretically, they should have a higher percentage. It's a recessive gene. But
yeah, right. Okay. So there's something about... In the 1500s in England was really bad, really, really bad.
DRD4. Yeah.
The 1400s had already been pretty bad, but like 1500s was really bad. Bloody Queen Mary scared the hell out of everybody. I mean, if you've got a queen who, starts chopping off heads and hanging people in public and burning witches all around the country in public. So like everywhere in Britain you go, you might walk over them and not notice them, but there's little plaques where people were burnt to death like on that spot, and the whole town stood round and watched some woman get burnt to death. That psychologically scars you. Families had to go to hide, and the Protestants were in real dire ways at one point, and then the Catholics were in fear at another point. So there was loads of fear, and it was all a fear and a lack of freedom. And everybody, I think, in Britain around the 1500s and the early 1600s felt that the Civil War was coming, knew that the English Civil War was on its way, that it couldn't keep going on like this, and it kept turning round battle after battle, and it was coming eventually, and there was more stricter rules coming in. I think Parliament was having an effect that it would, like, people were felt really like they were downtrodden. And so a lot of the people who left, these adventurers who created the new world, did so wanting to find that freedom to not be burnt at the stake, and etc. And they were the real brave ones, because a load of them had lands and minor titles. So they would get benefits from staying on their ass and not doing anything if they stayed at home. But instead, they had this idea, oh, we're going to go across sea and completely go on an adventure. So the lady I was talking about earlier, her family tree is made up just nearly solely of those people. There's no one else. They're all the adventurers who like are leaving. The pilgrims, the founding fathers, who were all like, one of them is like the founder of Connecticut. Like it's like you've got people who really just said no, we're going to create something completely new. That's got to be a selection of genes to be able to take that risk, to be intelligent enough to be able to handle that sort of like exercise, to be like strong enough to be able to defend yourself and understand that, you know, have that ability to have friends and companions and keep your family together, and to risk leaving everything that you're entitled to because of the fear of war. And they were right. The majority of people who got out of Britain knew at the time what was going on. I mean, if we could read newspapers at the time in the 1600s that were honest and true, they would be people panicking all over the place, all over the shop, and saying, we've got to get out of here before they start doing it. Can you imagine you're young and you're being told of these stories that happened to great granddad so and so who got burnt at the stake? You'd like, yeah, you're not gonna, can we do something different? And so those people seem to have had, like, they must have a trait that's in common, that they're willing to do that. And then the ones who stayed at home also must have had some sort of trait in common that they would make that decision. Because it's just, once you're in the frying pan, I mean, a lot of it, of course, can be social conditions as well. You know, you've just got too much to gain by staying at home and not going off to the new world. But there was I think there was also, people forget that just because it was the past, it doesn't mean people didn't fantasize and make up, spread propaganda about how great the next place was, and say that it's, you know, it's heaven, it's land of milk and honey, you know, it's a new place to go. And so if you're scared of being burnt to death, you're being taxed heavily, you're low down in the pecking order, and your kids have got less opportunity than, and you're watching it all fall apart, no doubt you're gonna, doesn't mean that they were all nice people, but it does mean that they all had that, like, adventurous spirit to dare. And there was a lot of organizations around that time as well, like the Merchant Adventurers Company, I think one of them was called, something along those lines, that were kind of like the precursor to the East Indies Trading Company and stuff. You know, they were the people who were going to go and colonize multiple places until they eventually got to somewhere like places like India, which had systems that, like the Raj, where they could take over extremely easily, and they would, within 10, 20 years, they would be in control of the entire country. Ingenuity. The British were just amazing at colonizing, but all the colonizers were like, he wants something too. And so they benefited from colonialization in the fact that they often created the new world and what the rules were out in these new places. But genetics. A lot of it.
It's interesting. It's fascinating. But I think one of the things that really struck me that you were talking about, like, you can't otherize because you're all part of this, you know, web essentially. And you're, I think that really kind of, it's a fascinating to think about. And it is kind of mind boggling. But I think the thing come to mind is, you know, this is something I spent a lot of time thinking about, is really, like, you know, what is consciousness, and, you know, how much individuality do we have? How much collectiveness do we have? That seems to be a constant battle, right? And I really think that neither one is correct. And typically, we're caught in very binary thinking. And it seems like, you know, it's a combination of both. Like, each person that makes up that genetic line has a role. They have a very significant time, place in history, and they have a very significant impact that impacts that the rest of the family and it impacts history, you know, whether you know about it or not. But, you know, there's a ripple effect, right? And, you know, partly it's through genetics, but it's part of, I believe we have free will. I know Sam Harris on the IDW doesn't, but I do. And I think, you know, through the free will, you know, we make choices, we take action. Some of us take risk, and, you know, some of those risks turn the course of history. And so I think it is really interesting, because I still think there is, you know, there are differences, there's huge differences. And when you talk about, you know, the othering, you had mentioned there's the elites, right? And I think there are definitely, there's a desire to impose will on others. And that, I think, has been, you know, really, there's all of these, I call them target audiences at this point, you know, it's just for marketing purposes. But we have all these like ideological categories, you know, the left, right, the conservative, liberal, Democrat, Republican, whatever it may be. And I do call them target audiences for marketing, because at this point, that seems to be, I'm not denying that they don't have any philosophical roots or, you know, ideological premises. But, you know, now today is kind of, you know, to target for various marketing campaigns for propaganda to socially engineer the masses. And but when I look at what the battle really is, it seems like a battle for, you know, the cliche, the battle for the mind. And I, you know, this again goes back to psychology, right? But it seems like it's the battle between the people who want to be free, honor free will, want others to be free, and those who want to enslave others. And, you know, whether that be, you know, through, by whatever means, you know, and it seems like there's a, you know, it's a multi-layered though, because yes, you do have these kind of maybe ruling classes, and they have pressures on them too. You know, you might be born into that. And then what are you risking if you don't fulfill the obligations that have been set before you? And then it may be, you know, as you pointed out, some bloodlines, right? So we know there's ritualistic kinds of practices that occur through certain bloodlines. You know, you could call them occultists, and maybe they subscribe to a specific worldview, but that gets perpetuated through actions and through rituals. And those rituals lead to trauma, to blackmail, to bribery, to essentially which have mind control capacities, right? So I don't know. It's all very fascinating, but it's all very complex.
Walter and Stanley Peterson, Jordan B. Peterson's father and grandfather, they come from a line with probably zero like fancy past at all. But right. It's his mother's line that then has that line. So once they're married, does it get, you know, we always think, how does that get passed down? How does, who keeps that list? Who knows? But I suppose it's just a case of, it's a case of you thinking that you can apply for something because something else has happened. And it's just a process that opens up over time. It's really hard to know how they make these sort of decisions, if they do make these sort of decisions, because it becomes very, as soon as you're entering into the selection process for Freemasonry or whatever, I don't know, it's some sort of like cultish, deep cult. It comes to a point where we don't understand their selection process. And this is, it's really important, I think. We were talking about, I think before we started, I'm not sure, maybe we were talking on the show earlier. Oh my God, listen to us. about the fact of, yeah, we talked a lot today about the fact that it's been said that 30 to 60% of people don't have an inner monologue. So they don't.
This was like, before, so the audience hasn't heard it. So you can go through.
Yeah, yeah. So 30 to 60% of people. I always in these cases like to say 30% of people. I like to go low end figure. They don't have inner monologue, so they don't think things out. They don't think things through. They're obviously, those people would be more susceptible to being told to do something. And yeah. So is that genetically given to him over time? Is that the, or is that a psychology coping mechanism once trauma set in some way? Or the idea that they could get trauma, the ideation of trauma? I don't quite know how to describe it, but some people switch off. And this has been said when like cruise ship disasters happen and stuff. Mm-hmm. Some people will just be standing there and they'll be staring into space and they'll blank off completely because it's just too much trauma for their mind to take. So they gotta switch off.
Other people rise to the occasion.
Fight or flight, you know, yep. It's the old adage there. And the people either run or they don't. And this is true all of the time. And maybe that's like a sign of people who don't have an inner monologue, who can't use logic and reasoning. Now, whether that gets taken away or not, I think that's that sort of systematic taking away of reason and logic, though we try and do it to people with reason and logic. Okay. I don't think it's something that is only given to you. I think it's something that is probably genetically there, that doesn't match up in the brain. Maybe it's something to do with trauma, birth, maybe it's something to do with something else that happens in the womb, or a lack of something that we used to have, our ancestors used to have, but we don't have anymore, or whatever it is. We, like, some people don't have that inner monologue. I said to you earlier, maybe some people have, like 30% of people have way too much inner monologue, but that will go for every, that sort of idea will go for every trait probably. And then you have loads of crossovers of traits, and people look for partners who match their aspirations, match their goals. And so you have a family of people who all have these obvious genetic traits, and some of that is mixed in with something that we can't, that is beyond our obvious sensory realm. There is obviously an element that we connect with people or we don't. You know, if I meet someone and they're completely and utterly wonderful and they're brilliant and etc., then, and I connect with them and they connect with me, wow, that's amazing. That's like a bingo, because it's really hard to find. Maybe that's like, there's a genetic element to that too. Maybe all of these things that we talk about, the rising to the occasion, the falling down and not being able to cope and hiding away, all of these things are actually things are handed down. So all of the lines will be attracted to their own type, will be in social groups that are akin to their own type, will express like that throughout their life, until by the time that they're going to have children, they're meeting people who are a lot like them and have that same gene, and it somehow communicates in a way, or that sort of like, and again, it does somehow, it doesn't have to communicate. It's a selection of things that happen that make that person take on certain traits that lead them to be at a certain level in society. You're either a boss or you're not, you know. You're either flicking out ones or you're flicking out zeros. There's loads of NPC families out there. We all know them. People who just, like, they're switched off completely. They marry people who are switched off completely, because people who are switched on won't be with them, you see. Have you ever been in an area where you've met someone who's completely switched on and their wife's completely dumb? You know, it's like it just does not last. It has to be that people have to be. Well, I say that, you know, there's elements of these things, but of course, there's going to be crossover. But really, mostly, if people are marrying, especially in the past when rules were stricter, or at least society was stricter about that sort of thing, you're likely to be looking for people you click with, that you have an underlying sort of like genetic sort of thing with, and your family will be selecting that for you a lot of the time, and they'll be selecting it being like, oh, that family is like us in many ways and does the things and is at the level that we are, and we are going to combine as a family because that makes us proud that we are both at the same level, and etc. So like the expression of genes over time have ended up creating society and culture. And that seems obvious when you say that, you know, out loud. But for us, trying to think of it and rationalize it in historical context is just messy in the mind.
Yeah, well, there's so much there. I think there's a couple of things. So when I think about people, you know, they, I think they're a combination of nature, nurture, and fate, right? And my mom's a psychologist, actually. She always used to say, never underestimate the power of fate. And I think that's really true. These are the circumstances in life. These are, you know, the situations that may occur, and they can be pivotal. They can be life-changing, right? And they definitely have an impact on us, for better, for worse. And I think the other element that, you know, you could encompass this in faith, and of course, this, you know, definitely depends on your worldview. But I think of us as being like, you know, we're mind, spirit, we're mind, body, spirit, right? And heart, I would say, like emotional. But that's, yeah, kind of a combination of mind, body. But I think it's its own thing. But I really think it's all of those things, right? And I think people underestimate that spiritual component, because when you're talking about like what it draws people to each other, you know, and you were talking about people being switched on, being switched off, this is going to sound kind of woo-woo, but I really don't think it is. I think, you know, there's a lot of quantum, you know, physics that has alluded to this, that there's a biofield around us. You know, our heart has a electromagnetic field up to 12 feet. That's huge. So when they say some people are more magnetic than others, they mean it literally. Some people actually have a wider magnetic field. And so everything really is energy. And I don't know so much about like being switched on, being switched off, but typically people, and not just romantically, but I think in terms of relationships, all different types of relationships, it's a lot about frequency. That's why I said, I know it's going to sound kind of woo-woo, but really it's like you resonate on a certain frequency, and mm-hmm. that either matches or doesn't. And I think we find that all over the place in all types of relationships and all types of interactions and dynamics, and it affects the dynamics. You know, what people, you know, they say like people wear many faces, and it's, you know, yes, sometimes it's more appropriate in a work setting to, you know, actors can behave a certain way, but it's not just that. A lot of it has to do with the energy in the room, the circumstance, the situational pressures. And I think all of those are factors. Do genetics play a role? I think genetics play a role, but because there's nature, nurture, and fate, there's, you know, epigenetics. And I think a lot of it is what gets expressed, what gets turned on. And I think that this is something that the throughout history, and this goes back millennia, that people have studied, whether they studied it in, you know, these the same kind of terminology that we understand it today, probably not. But, you know, I think for better or for worse. And when you look at some of the you know, darker elements. And I think, you know, studying the dark helps you understand the light and vice versa. So I think it's, you know, good to understand both, right? You were talking about knowing your enemy. And I think it is really helpful, because usually it's the opposite of that. And when you look at some of the darker elements of this, is some of this like, you know, ritualized trauma-based mind control goes all the way back to the mystery schools. And that's, you know, we're talking thousands of years ago, it's millennia. And they did keep it within. So there is a certain sort of programming. When you talk about like, how does someone know what their place is? Is it all about their genetic capability? I do think that, you know, we all have different personalities. We all have different gifts and talents. And, you know, I personally believe we were all endowed with unique gifts and talents, and it's incumbent upon each of us to harness those, hone them, let our passions guide them, us toward them, so that we can be of contribution to the world. You know, I think that's part of our journey. But I
just wanted to say that I think that, I agree completely with the idea of frequency, but I also believe it kind of like, to land as well, is mm-hmm. you either resonate with the land and resonate with the person as well, and mm-hmm. and that kind of gives you the grounding. Oh god, that's but I think it's also extremely, because I was trying to think of how to describe it when you were talking there, because it's a real personal thing that people don't want to describe. So I met a girl recently who was astounding, completely and utterly boggled my mind. Like, mm-hmm. how can someone be this perfect? And she's not perfect. Of course, mm-hmm. she's not perfect. She's human being, etc. No one's going to be perfect on when we're skin and bone and all of that. We make silly decisions, but she completely and utterly wonderful. You either click or you don't. You meet someone and you have this really personal experience of being like, oh, right, okay, you are completely on my level, but in a way that is not social, is not about how we speak or what we brought up doing, you know, or it's something else. It's something that resonates at a different level where you realize that you can't. There's people who are going to be able to maybe attract a load of people by looks and etc. and by superficial means, but we all know that superficiality probably leads to sadness and a feeling of loneliness and emptiness, where what we're talking about is something about a connection that most people will never be able to find because it's extremely hard to understand, and sometimes, you know, it presents differently. It's like trying to connect somebody with somebody, with sort of like meditation with another person in that way. I suppose it's a semi-tantric or whatever. I don't know what you call it. That only happens with certain people. You can't have that connection with certain people. So there's going to be an element where you can't even test out some energy, but something happens that allows you to feel it at some point and connect with it. And if you meet someone at that time, if you meet someone, it's really dangerous because you could potentially give up your life, yeah, for someone that you've gone buzzed with and you're like, oh my God, energy galore. And this is what makes, you know, this whole wisdom to understanding what that energy is. And human beings, very impossible because we can't talk about it. Because if we talk about it, we have to talk about our personal experience. I don't want to tell you about my personal experience. I don't want to tell you about all of the things that go on in my mind when I'm attracted to someone. That's so super personal. You can only get like emotionless statistics at best if you're going to get those, or you're going to get like all of the way on the other way, or all of the way on the other way. You're not going to get something honest. You're going to get people projecting out parts of their own fears and stuff like this. But most of it is just like a feeling you can't describe, an energy you can't describe, a vibrant, whatever you call it. But sometimes someone walks by and you know, oh, that's it. That's done. my attention is completely grabbed, and there's nothing different that person's done than anybody else has done, you know. So it's clear to, I think, to most people. Now, when you compare that to someone who, like, the idea someone does have an inner monologue, someone doesn't have an inner monologue, someone does have energy that can attract, and someone who doesn't have energy to it that they can attract. On average, I think maybe it's Jordan Peterson who said, is it Jordan Peterson who I learned this from? That is something like, in most places anyway, 50% of men have an average of 0 babies, and 50% of men have an average of 2 babies. You know, there's crossover in all of that. But you either impregnate 2 women probably, or you're not successful with mating at all. You're not successful at mating because you're unable to rationalize it because you don't have an inner monologue, but maybe there's something else missing from there. Maybe there's an energy missing. Maybe the reason you don't have an inner monologue is because you're unable to connect with something that resonates that we can't understand. And because we can't understand it, we see it as kooky and hoodoo, but it's probably something very explainable that gives us that. And you either have the energy or not. And you either have an inner monologue or not. And you either have the logical mind to cope with this or you know, to understand the fallacy over there or not. You could be addicted or not. We kind of know that. I know people who just like, just aren't interested in either drinking, smoking, anything. They're so far away from being able to be addicted to anything. You know, they just don't have that sort of thought. People say, oh, they got the accountant gene, where you're a bit boring and whatever, and you know, and you like doing the numbers. So that's another gene that you've. But all of these like collections, it's like maybe it's connected to an energy as well. You know, the energy you let off is what you're attracted to doing, who you're attracted to being with, where you're attracted to living, you know, everything. And so then it questions, where does that energy come from? And is it something that is beyond us? Because, I mean, when we're dealing with energy, then we're not dealing with the physical realm anymore.
Exactly.
That's where people go, what? Yep. Where are you going with it?
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's the piece. That is it. I think there's so many different components. And you talk about these different bloodlines and you talk about tying it to the modern day, which I think is part of where your interest came from, because there seems to be like who gets appointed, how do certain figures get promulgated, how does a controlled opposition work, right? Who even gets to be put in that category, why things like the intellectual dark web. I still have questions about the funding, although it does look like we know for sure the CIA funded the Tor browser, right? A component of that for the IDW. So we know there was some tie there. And then there's the Peter Thiel connection. I don't know fully. We know the Weinstein father also had some intelligence connection. So I feel like it's all tied together. When you look at, you said how in previous, you know, like our ancestors in previous times, of course, not everybody had the ability to just pick, you know, who they were going to create their own family with. You know, sometimes that was done for them. And in certain bloodlines, it was really important to keep, you know, within the family and keep those bloodlines together and intact.
Think this with what you're saying here. This is a wonderful way to think of it. Like, if I go to one line of my family, or one line to Jordan Peet's family, or to my friend Laurie's family, or one of the many other families, I'll end up sometime in Somerset. And Somerset people, past, say, 1600, 1500, 1400 AD, going backwards, they always married Somerset people. Mm-hmm. And Gloucester people always married Gloucester people. And Devonian people, the people from Devon, only married, and Cornish people nearly always. And it was only in the 1600s, 1700s where it started to be like, you know, you'd find someone who was originally born in Somerset hanging around in Cornwall or in somewhere up north or something like that, had married into another family that was further away. There was no sense to it before. There was more sense to it once there was infrastructure that allowed people to travel a little bit further. But the majority of time, for the majority of history, all of these families, all of your certain lines, were all in a certain place in the world. Every single one of them. Like, say, 1,000, 2,000 ancestors or some stuff like that. That's crazy, but it's true.
Yeah.
Something like that, 2,000 ancestors all hanging around in the same place for however many years. And they all take in that place, they love that place, they are that place. And then later on
to that land,
and you go through as an ancestor, you have no idea you're living there. Now this show I did was called Who Do They Think They Are, which is of course a pun on the classic genealogy show, Who Do They Think They Are, Who Do You Think You Are, or is that what it is? Who Do You Think You Are? So it's a twist on that. And on one of those episodes, Jeremy Irons was on one of the episodes years ago. This is about 2008 or something. And he was talking about having Irish ancestors and how it was really strange, because he discovered the ancestors that he felt like a connection to, he had already gone and purchased land nearby in Ireland where he could go and live, where these people had come from. And he had felt like a connection with the land before he discovered that he had actually come from that land. Now, I know that's just one, that's a very anecdotal example, sure. But I've seen it. I think energy isn't just something that comes from a human per se, but it also comes from where the human's been. Humans being been, and that connection, that I don't know how that works, how that fits in, but that means that genetics, the genes, they like to look for their own, because maybe they resonate, that energy resonates in the same way if they come from a same certain area. Maybe you can always find connections in people's family tree. Their mother and father end up going back to roughly the same area where they had. I don't know. But the whole thing is that there's like more than just human energy. There's a lot of energy. And if we could just name two, there's probably another 37.
Yeah. Well, there's a theory, you know, that DNA is really like an antenna to God. So, you know, there's a, and it does kind of seem like we have some sort of an antenna to a higher being, a higher, whatever that is for you. You know, I mean, I it's not for me to tell people what to believe, but, you know, it does kind of seem that way. Like we are connected. And I, you know, that doesn't mean that we're not individuals and that we don't have a very distinct, you know, makeup and personality and purpose and all of that. But I would argue, and then that would make sense that the genetic connection, you know, if it's really coming from an antenna, I mean, that's DNA is the, you know, Watson and Crick were given the Nobel Prize, and it was a kind of fraudulent. Like I won't go into the whole story, but you know, they were kind of touted without really being worthy of giving the credit for, you know, the discovery. And so I have a lot of questions about, well, that, what does that mean for what genetics really are, and what, you know, how much do we really know about genetics? There seems to be no shortage of study of genetics. They did that whole genome project, and we saw honestly very little as a result of it. They're now, it seems like they're very determined to manipulate our genetics in whatever way possible. But I don't know how much they really know about genetics. And I'm not saying that to, I don't know. I honestly don't know, but I have a lot of questions because it seems like a lot of things are being sold as fact that are theoretical models, and we honestly don't have a lot of answers. So.
Yeah, I don't think there's. I think there's a load of stuff that we really. This is why I go back through history, and every person in every age always believes they're at the point of true enlightenment, and that you can't really get further than this. And we're just around the corner from you know, the Holy Grail and all of that of technology. That's exactly what we're doing most of the time here, and we don't. Loads of stuff is wrong. There's loads of stuff. There's obviously, you know, you can't, people can't agree on most things nowadays. And I don't know. I try and explain this. I had a altercation. It's not really an altercation. It is an altercation, but it was with someone I love, who's a really nice person who lives around here. And we had a conversation about Andrew Kaufman, who was coming on TNT radio show. And so you know, I gave Andrew Kaufman a bit of space to talk about things that I knew that some people don't like, and I had said to her that he was coming on. I explained what he was, and I live in an area where there's a hospital just over the way, so she got very angry. Her husband works at the hospital as well, and I love her very much. We've cried on each other's shoulders. We are very good. We're good friends in the area. She's like beautiful. She's also got a massive I think it's a new Newfoundland is called. It's just massive furry bear like creature sort of dog that is amazing. So Loki, just every dog in the park's called Loki. But she was so offended and had such a hard time accepting that someone else had a you know, a point of view that was different, that you can hold a different point of view about something so fundamental as science and medicine. Mm-hmm. And but our whole system's built on this. Yeah. Our whole system's built on this. So it's got to be right. It's got to be right. It's very interesting, man, Andrew Kaufman. I, you know, again, someone who oh, man. I'm not sure if I agree with or not, because I haven't made up my mind about any of it, because I don't trust the people on the one side, and I don't really, by trade, I don't trust anybody. That's the best thing to do. And then you work off that and you go upwards and you're like, oh, now I've get that person's gained trust. Dung, 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 you know, as they go along. And I like him. I like him that he's being fairly honest. But a while back, there was a guy called Bill Houston who made a list and put me on a list. I'm not sure if I discussed this with Kaufman. But the list was... I was on the list, some other people I knew were on the list, and it was people who believed in viruses, people who believed in germ theory.
Right.
And I was like, I said to him, this isn't like, you know, this ain't fair. Not because I'm on the list, just because I'm not sure I believe in germ theory. I think you labeled me as believing, but I don't think I believe in either theory at the moment. And I haven't had enough like information. And when I look at it, I'm like, I don't trust all of these different people. I mean, I'd already researched the Wellcome Trust and all of the scientists I seem to research. A lot of them are being told what to do, and they do this and they get a positive if they put it in this machine, etc. Keeps everybody in these boxes, and loads of people everywhere are dying in horrible ways. It doesn't seem to do much in the grand scheme of things, and I'm suspicious about that. And then they've manipulated what we think are germs, but then in the same way they're spraying us all from above, and they've been doing it for years and years. I mean,
things and poisoning us in all sorts of ways.
Unbelievable, man. Well, before I did the Wellcome 5 article, I went to do it. I went to sit down, and then I was like, oh, shit, I got to write this other article. I looked into this guy called Brian Spratt, who was going to be part of the article. And I worked out, I had to do a whole one about Porton Down's ideological cloud. So you had to like look at what Britain had been doing through the whole Porton Down from 1917, I think it's set up properly, all of the way through. And again, in Somerset. Oh, no, it's Wiltshire. I think it might be Wiltshire because it's up near. Yeah, sorry, it's Wiltshire because it's up near Salisbury. And Porton Down, like they sprayed 100% of the country. You've got this old video clip, you know, like, welcome to Porton Down, the England's biological warfare lab. Here, people look at all of these different viruses, blah, 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 blah. And in the background, they've got this board up, and it shows three pictures. I think it's three pictures of Porton Down, Britain, and it shows like lines going across it. And what you discover from the records of the time is that's where they were spraying things like E. coli and zinc, cadmium sulfide over 100% of the country, and testing how many people went into hospital, how many people got cancer, how many people got leukemia, birth defects. Evil. And this is post-war, World War II, this is the most evil experimentations. They're putting people in gas chambers and gassing people. They're giving them chemicals. They're doing all sorts of different terrible, nasty experiments on people for donkey's years. And then they got very good at hiding it. This happens all throughout intelligence within the late 70s, 80s, 90s. And then they did this whole thing where they were like, they invited a few people who had been affected by these experiments and were like, oh, yes, come down to Porton Down, this is what we're doing down here, and we still deny that we did anything to you. You know, it was just awful. And you got these guys like there was a kid, I think his name was Ronnie Madison. I think his name was Ronnie Madison, who died an awful death at Porton Down went there thinking he was going to have one type of experiment, and then he died in such an awful way. I think it was like at some point it's described his leg turned completely blue and he could crack it like it was glass, something along those lines. I mean, it was just like esoteric crap that they were doing there. As soon as you work out they're doing that, you're done. You're like, okay, how can I trust that that's germ theory then, if you're doing exactly what the terrain theory people say is happening, that you're spraying everybody and you're doing all this? Well, you are doing that, so can you stop doing that? Ronnie Madison. It's a really sad story. Don't get me looking into the like that is a really, really sad story. There's like the port and down stuff is really like evil stuff. There was one village in Dorset, I think it's East Lulworth, I think it was called. And they were spraying E. coli. They were spraying E. coli out of planes, trains, the back of cars, the ships, mainly out of ships and planes. And they sprayed all of the
always under military research, right? That's always
And in this one case, they got down to the Dorset coastline and they dumped out all of this chemical over the coastline in summer. The entire south coast is covered in people, who are from all over the country. They spray them with E. coli, and then they get to East Lulworth and they've got a load left over, so they dump it all out in one. And afterwards, it's just loads of people having birth defects in this very small place. And they discover later on that that was the place where they dumped out all this chemical after this, when they did this whole, oh, we'll reveal some of the things we did and then say that we even though this is all the evidence and it shows it, that we didn't really do anything wrong and we're not going to say sorry. And well, you know, they kind of changed rebranded themselves as whatever they're called now. But they're still porting down. And the people of East Lulworth, massive birth defects. They were trying to fight for some form of justice. And the person who did the review of multiple cases of this, who, you know, the cleanup man, was this guy, Brian Spratt. And Brian Spratt's mentor, Roy Anderson is real big in Royal Society. He pushed HIV stuff at the start. He's was head of the Wellcome Trust before it was Wellcome Trust as well, when it was welcoming, when it was doing some bad stuff. Of course, Burroughs Wellcome were pushing AZT over in America during this time. Roy Anderson was, 91, 92, head of Wellcome in the UK, just as it was merging and changing. And Jeremy Farrar would be recruited the next year, alongside with Edward C. Holmes, who was giving out recruitments at a Wellcome Oxford crossover. This was all overseen by Richard Sykes, and all of these people had this massive role during COVID. They were a central part. Richard Sykes was the man.
Fauci was involved in AGT also.
Yeah, of course. And then Fauci, who does Fauci hand over, COVID's planning to, but Jeremy Farrar, who's of course joins Wellcome in about 93, 94, I think 94, just as the merger's happening to Glaxo, merging with Wellcome. And Beecham Smith Kline are merging together, and it all comes out of that. There's this whole like cabal of people that come with these sort of projects, and they're poisoning us. So the idea is terrain theory or virus. Well, all of the people who are pushing germ theory and zoonotic spread and stuff like that. nearly every single one of those is a nefarious bastard. That's what I've discovered.
It's like really the father of virology is John Franklin Enders. And he was another secret society guy. He was a member of Scroll and Key. He was a Nobel laureate. And he was a vaccinologist. Like he's kind of like the father of virology.
There's something really. Oh man, I'm about to release an article on NewsPaste. Okay. I don't know how long before it goes up. It's a couple of weeks. Okay. I already released a tiny bit of research on it. Yeah. But there's something really beautiful about it. It's about a man called Reginald Farrar. He was also big on virology and pandemics back in the day. Would you think that he's related to Jeremy Farrar? He like Jeremy Farrar went off to East Asia. Reginald Farrar went off to East Asia. He went to Manchuria for the outbreak in 1910-11. He was a Mason. He was a League of Nations, Norton Foundational Institute. I can't remember which one it is. How they say it. He was sent over to check out this Manchurian plague and take loads of notes and bring those notes back. And they went through them, and some of it is just like, you know, what is really interesting. This is why I'm telling you this. Now, one of the things that's really interesting is that it was an excuse. They went over there, all these people dying. It's said it's a marmot. You know what was happening is marmots. Normally, when people caught them, they caught them on horseback. They chase them down and they loop them round and they catch them. Those are the trappers. Fur was going up in value. Western fur market was booming, so they were getting lazy and they were going to the marmot like dens and they were digging out the marmots. Those marmots, Tarabagan marmots, were sick and dying. This is the story. And that led to the pneumonic plague in Manchuria. That's the story. And what that plague did was allow a load of men. So, for instance, Dr. Strong from the who was from the Institute in Manila for medicine at the time. He was nominated by the Rockefellers to go and be the American representative in Manchuria. You had the most evil man in Japan's history, Kitasato Shibasaburo, who was one of the kings of experimenting on humans, was a Japanese representative. Zabolotny, who was head of the Female Institute in, I think it was St. Petersburg or somewhere, whatever that was at the time. He was a Russian candidate. He was a guy who gave himself tuberculosis to prove his vaccine cured him, or so he said. A lot of this is so he said. Yes. There was a guy called Hafkins who was a plug in Hafkins prophylactic. And this is really important. Of course, Reginald Farrar for the British. Dr. Wu, who was presenting the International Symposium in Manchuria for all of these guys to meet and mingle, was the guy who invented the N95 mask. He was the actual. So this was all the genesis of all of that happening.
And Dr. Wu invented we just have to like highlight
1910-11. We're talking 1910-11.
I get it, but how weird. Dr. Wu invents the N95 mask, and then we have the, you know, bat virus, whatever story they make out of Wuhan lab. I mean, it's kind of weird. Yeah,
Dr. Wu has another name attached to him. I can't remember what his first name is or whatever, but his family name.
I just
name
had to
is
point
Wu,
that out. It's weird.
Yeah, it is. It is weird. But this international symposium gave these guys something that was really. And this is what the real thing is. Okay, so this is where it could. They could say all of this is a Tarabagan marmot, where they're actually someone's. You know, feeding something to fleas and making them with fleas bite people and then people get ill, or maybe it's a sickness that is spread in another way through another chemical or something. Who knows what the actual, but this was the peak of this sort of virus research. And what you discover is a load of these people, there was this document written. It's called, you'll be able to find it, it's written in 1911 by Reginald Farrar, and it's called Plague in Manchuria. and it includes notes at the end of questions and answers about the plague and what the response was. So all of these guys, these big guys, come across to Manchuria, and they are the that is the one. Sorry, I didn't see it earlier. In the end of that, there's this question and answers where they say basically all of the different experiments that they were doing over there. Mm-hmm. And it became a free for all. You see, all these people were sick all of a sudden, and they were like, what we can do? And this is where you could believe germ theory be the same. You know, they're testing, it became an all out right to test on the Tarabagan marmot. The poor marmot was buggered. They were sticking them in. They were testing on every animal they could possibly. They were doing gain of function experiments. That's Dr. Wu there. They were doing gain of function experiments. They were, it was like literally everything went. They had a ability to try and create a vaccine using, they'd already like had what, variola vaccines, other vaccines. Of course, you had smallpox. No, it was before that. But it was a cowpox sort of vaccine. What was it? I'm not going to be able to remember. But anyway,
smallpox or
I'm not sure. No, it was the earlier thing. I think it was maybe it was something. It was a vaccine. The vaccine that you had to have. I'm very tired. I've had a long day. Vaccine you had to have a for the cows. Yes, it's got to be small. Is that smallpox? Because it was cowpox. But you had to get like a piece of meat that was infected, and then they cut a hole in. Now, I went back and looked at Reginald Farrar's notes, and he actually worked vaccinating before he went out to China, to Manchuria. He was actually a vaccinator, an official vaccinator. And he describes this event with this one girl where they pierced the skin with an infected whatever scalpel and the wound doesn't heal. And he's like, I should have known that the girl would take sick leave from the fact she was so thin and stuff and emaciated, but I hoped that it would heal, but it didn't heal. And then she died of from the effects of vaccination. And when they went over to Manchuria, these guys had a free-for-all. They were like, we can test on loads of different people. They tested a load of potential cures by infecting. They said to a load of prisoners who had a death sentence, oh, we can infect you all. We will vaccinate you. And if you survive, you can go free. And so, of course, what are you going to do if you're attached to a death sentence? You're gonna do whatever they want. Now, these same people, it leads up to, like, you think 1917, right? There's two things. 1914, you've got sleeping sickness appears and then goes extinct in the 50s or 60s. That's when you got Awakenings with Robert De Niro and Robin Williams. That's about someone who's got that I think it's an encephalitis or something like that. And you've got the Spanish flu appears suddenly in 1917. And this is after they're doing all gain of function experiments over and over are documented in this document, Plague in Manchuria, where they're going out and they're trying their vaccines. Like Hafkin tried Hafkin's prophylactic, which was, but didn't work very much. And some people died, of course, because that happens when they're testing out these.
Right. Well, there's also all the technology at that time, too, right? Especially with the Spanish flu. Yeah. And I think that was a factor as well, because it was originally called telegrapher's disease. Arthur Furstenberg, the Invisible Rainbow book, he talks about that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, my internet was glitching a little bit, I think. Then.
Yeah, I know. You froze at a very funny time. But
yeah, that's me. I got a load of freezing at funny times, but I think my internet might be going, so I might have
we can wrap this up. It's been a while and it's been awesome. I know it's been a long day. So I don't know if you have anything else you want to leave us with, if you want to And of course, tell everybody where they can find you and all that good stuff. But
yeah, well, I mean, I'm on weekdays now on TNT Radio. I mean, it's Central Time. Your time is about 11 till 1. And my time is 4 till 6 at the moment, but that'll change to 5 till 7. So it's a drive time slot in the UK on TNT Radio, enjoying it loads, of course. And I just got loads of projects going on. You know, I like meeting people at the moment. I did Comcast Comedy Festival where I spoke live, and I hope there's more events like that come up over the summer. I'd like to go out and meet more people and just have a little bit more fun. I do a lot of these read-throughs. I got a lot of shows going on, you know, a lot of content for people to see. Mm-hmm. But I'm just trying to work lots and trying to make something. I mean, Newspaste is the main place to find my work, and I try and make it as easy as possible to navigate and to find this.
All right, well, it looks like we lost him, unfortunately. I think the internet was going fading out there. One of the incredible things about the technology, right, that we can do this overseas and connect with people all over the world, but sometimes it gets a little bit challenging. So I hope you really enjoyed that. Definitely follow his work. He is an incredible journalist. He is doing some phenomenal work, really deep, deep investigative journalism. And yeah, you can find him on newspace.com. And that is him on X. I still call it Twitter, but yes, at Johnny Bedmore. And of course, you can click the links below to support my work if you'd like to see me continue. So yeah, thank you all so much for watching and listening.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.